When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hello to you. How you doing? I'm speaking to you on, Friday afternoon. Golly, the week's gone quick. Blimey. And I've still got the last little bits of a beautiful, it's a really beautiful sunny day, actually. That lovely golden light. And the weather has been teasing us. It goes from heat wave to proper autumn chill in a day, it feels like. So this morning it was all kind of cold when we left for school and the kids wanted their coats and I put them in shorts and it wasn't really shorts weather. But now it's actually really quite warm, so hopefully they've forgiven me by now. And I think we're kind of getting into our September stride a little bit, although I have to say I feel pretty exhausted. I don't know. My secondary school kids, well, in particular my 11-year-old, when he comes home, he's always got quite a lot of homework now. And I have to sit and do it with him. And I just don't think I'm a very good teacher. I think I'm a bad teacher. And he's very sweet because he always wants to understand the answers, which obviously is like the right thing to do. But I'm a bit like, let's just get this done. The answer's this. And obviously that's the wrong attitude. I do know that's the wrong attitude. So I'm trying to actively like slow myself down, explain stuff, get him to do the solutions and work it out. But then, yeah, I just find it a bit overwhelming sometimes because I never really know if the emphasis with homework is on him finishing it or him understanding it. Understanding it would mean we probably spend about double the time sometimes. And also, I've kind of done school. I don't necessarily want to do it again. What is the obsession in biology with an animal cell and a plant cell and the differences between them? I swear to God, I've done that now with like, I'm on my 3rd kid doing it, and I remember, it's all I kind of remember from GCSE biology, to be honest with you. Plant cell, animal cell. There's the vacuole. Job done. Anyway, what else is going on? Well, today I did another podcast, episode 4. Yeah, I am still scooping up ideas of new people. I've done another couple of bookings. It's shaping up well. I think I'm probably, I've probably got about half my guests for the next series. Sorted. That's quite a nice feeling. And there's a few trees I'm still shaking, but all good stuff, all lovely people, all people I think you'll be interested to hear their stories. And I've done my first meeting about what I'm wearing for my Christmas tour. Oh, that's my front door. Because it's Christmassy. And it's weird because normally the idea of thinking about Christmas in sort of September, October would be horrifying. I don't feel horrified by it at all. I'm actually completely there because suddenly I can sort of see that December will be here before I know it. So I've been planning my outfits and how I'm going to do one change into another change and what songs I'm going to sing. I'm quite excited about all that too. I'm sort of already feeling a little bit festive. Maybe it's the fact things are happening that always make you think of this time of year, like, I don't know, Strictly coming back on telly and you're like, well, that's another fast train to Christmas, isn't it? What else have I got to tell you about? I'm trying to think. You know what? I haven't really done very much this week. I've been staying at home quite a lot. I've had festivals and all that meant that I was away so much. I was away quite a lot of last weekend. So I'm just trying to really hunker down a little bit, just be home a bit more, keep on top of things here, continuing with the decluttering. I think I spoke to you about that last week. The piles of stuff are ready to go by the door. Yeah, all kind of... all pretty change of season stuff. And this week's episode is... So sometimes when Claire, my producer, and I record an episode, we feel like we get a bit of a sort of crush on our guest. And that is what happened with my guest for this week. So I spoke to Professor Alice Roberts. She's a TV presenter and she's a biological anthropologist. So she basically studies old bones, sometimes very ancient bones, and then tries to work out as much as she can about that person from their skeleton. So already fascinating stuff, right? And I first met her when we were both involved in a brilliant evening. Again, I've probably spoken to you about before, which is Brian Cox and Robin Ince. They do the Infinite Monkey Cage, a big Christmas show. So it's basically, it's called Compendium of Reason, and it's all people from the world of science and comedy and then some musicians too, who hop up and do a turn as part of this big evening, all held together by Brian and Robin, and they're introducing people and talking about space and the world and fascinating stuff. So a lot of scientists. So that's how I met Hannah Fry as well, who I had on recently. It's how I also met, Helen Glover, the rower, and now it led me to Alice Roberts. So Alice spoke and I met her briefly and I thought she seemed really cool and really interesting. So I invited her to do the podcast and, oh, what a woman. We had such a good chat. It was the perfect conversation, really, because whenever I'm inviting people onto this podcast, I always say my guests are all working women who happen to be mothers, and we talk about how motherhood has influenced work and vice versa, but that's kind of the icebreaker and we can talk about all other things, and that's basically what happened with Alice and I. So we did speak about how it felt to be raising her two children and her experience of all of that stuff and how it's that's intertwined with her work and how she's, you know, the bits it's made her feel differently about. But we also from there spoke a lot about humanism, because for a long time Alice was the president of the Humanist Society. She's now vice president. And this is something I'm really interested in. So it was a really, really lovely, proper conversation where you feel your brain cells all going in happiness. Oh, sorry, that was my cat's call at the same time. My cat just woke up from sleeping when I made that noise. Sorry, Titus, I was trying to mimic the sound of my brain cells doing something. See, he's not used to that noise either. And yeah, I just really enjoyed it. So Alice, thank you to you, and thank you to you, dear listener, for giving me your time again. I think you're going to enjoy this, so I will see you on the next. Well, should we start? Why don't we start with what you're up to at the moment? You just mentioned that this is quite a manic time for you, so what are you up to at the moment?
I am getting ready to film the next series of Digging for Britain, which always takes up quite a lot of my summer, because we travel around the country looking at different archaeological digs all over the place. So I'll be heading off to do that, I think, probably end of May, early June. Mm-hmm. But I'm squeezing in another series, which is for Channel 4, and it's, I think I can talk about it. Yeah. It's called Ottoman Empire by Train. So it's okay. A mixture of kind of travel and history.
Wow.
And I've just got back from Turkey, Bulgaria and Serbia.
Yes, I could see you were at places like that. Amazing.
Yeah, and next week I'm off to Romania. Yeah.
Wow. Because I was thinking about what you do. So broadly speaking, biological anthropology. But I was thinking that covers so much, because actually, in terms of your sciences, you've got anatomy, you've got forensics, you've got history, you've got humanity, you've got culture. It kind of covers tons of things. doesn't it? Like, you have to reach into so many pockets to work out humans and how the species has evolved and what we've been up to all this time.
Yeah, I think as it's gone on, I've become much more interested in, I suppose, all the kind of cultural aspects. My background is medicine and anatomy. So I still teach anatomy to medical students at Birmingham University. But I think that the biological anthropology means that you end up very often focusing on bones. So I suppose if you boil it right down to the nitty-gritty of it, or, you know, what it is on a daily basis, kind of hands-on, I look at old skeletons. So I look at those old bones, and I try and reconstruct a biography from the bones, which is something that, you know, when I started getting into that area of science, having been a medic, having been a doctor, I found it quite amazing how much you could tell just from a skeleton. I'm very focused on that kind of the kind of intimate details of those bones and that individual from that kind of biological perspective. But then as soon as you start to build that up, it is a little bit like you've got a patient and you're trying to find out about that patient and you're trying to understand them and understand their life. Mm-hmm. So you start to add on all of these aspects, which are more than just the biology. They're the kind of human experience and then the culture as well.
Well, that's extraordinary. Do you feel like you get a sort of link with the person as you're building the picture?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because you're interacting with an individual. So it feels very personal. Yeah.
I suppose there's a sort of poetry to it as well, because as you say, you're delving, you're getting a sense of what was going on historically, but looking at one life lived. And I suppose when we think of the past, things tend to get very clumped together and you forget about what an individual's experience of that time would be like, how their day would be, what they felt about things. You know, it's not like you can say across the board that one time in, you know, chapter of the world, they all felt the same way about things. But we sort of tend to do that a little bit.
Yeah, we do. We say things like, shorthand, the Romans believed this.
And exactly.
You go, no, of course. There isn't one thing that the Romans believed. No. There isn't one thing that Iron Age people believed. It would have been, you know, hugely diverse, and their experience of life would have been hugely diverse.
Exactly. So how did you make the leap between being a medic to what you do now with the archaeology?
Well, kind of by mistake. So I should be a surgeon, really. And I left medical school, did my house jobs in South Wales. So I was a junior doctor in Cardiff and in Bridgend. And then I was looking for the next step, and I knew I wanted to do surgery at that point. I loved surgery. I liked the craft of it. I really loved anatomy, or I still love anatomy. Mm. And it was kind of putting that anatomy into practice. So I was looking for next jobs and looking around at what that might be. And I spotted this really intriguing job in Bristol, which was just a six-month training post, six-month job where I would be doing a bit of surgical work as an SHO, as a senior house officer, mm-hmm. and also teaching anatomy at Bristol University. Mm-hmm. And there was somebody in the department called Dr. Jonathan Musgrave, who was a forensic anthropologist. And I've always been quite intrigued in old bones and forensic anthropology. I had an amazing retired surgeon called Richard Newell, who would teach anatomy at Cardiff when I was at Cardiff Medical School. And he would, you know, he'd tell us about arthritis and then he'd bring in examples of arthritis in archaeological bones. So I'd always had that in the kind of back of my mind that I was interested in that. So I thought, this 6 months job sounds really, really good because I'm carrying on with my surgical training. I'm teaching anatomy, which I love, and also you need to polish up your anatomy if you're going to be a surgeon. Mm. You have to do surgical exams, and that obviously involves quite a bit of anatomy. It's sort of the basics, isn't it, knowing how the body's put together. And then the opportunity to do a bit of research as well really intrigued me. So that was just going to be a six-month job.
Yeah.
Loved it. And while I was there, my boss, who ran anatomy on the medical course, left, and the department just wanted somebody to kind of look after anatomy for a bit. And it was a kind of fill-in job. And I thought, well, okay, I'll do this for another 6 months then. And then they said, do you want to stay on for another 6 months? And I was thinking, quite enjoying it. All the time I thought I'd go back to surgery. And then eventually there was the offer of doing a part-time PhD. And I thought, actually, you know, I am really enjoying this. I love anatomy, love the teaching. Really interested in the research that I'm getting into. So I made this kind of Yeah, very kind of gentle transition. So it wasn't like I woke up one morning and thought, I don't want to be a surgeon.
No.
I got kind of drawn into this other world, which I just hadn't expected at all.
But that's so lovely. And I guess that means if you've got that passionate curiosity, then gives you all that thirst to keep learning more and more. That's kind of, you're just able to follow your nose with it, really. Like,
yeah.
Where does this path lead me? And I suppose the big difference between the medical side of the studying anatomy and the surgical side, and then where you ended up, is you're looking at these bones to tell stories from people who have died and the past. And I think this makes me excited too. I've got a bit of a curiosity, I think, in, I suppose, the link between the living and the dead, really, and this experience we have and everything that we perceive is the world as we know it. But the fact that everything's evolving, and so the things we have access to, the way our world works, is not the same as it would have been 100 years ago, 500 years, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
But that is your experience. And we tend to forget that people who lived 1,000 years ago were full of just as much vitality. They got excited about things. They had up days, down days, things happening, adventures, whatever.
Yeah.
You sort of get it, this sort of like slightly faded idea of, I don't know, I suppose all emotions being muted because it's muted in our present. But that wouldn't have been the case for them then at all.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think that by the time, I mean, obviously, when you've got the written word, we've got that amazing, I mean, I just think that technology is incredible. And that must have been so, completely kind of life-changing and culture-changing when it
literally
it first
just people
came
being
along.
Able to write things or?
Yeah, people being able to write things. So if you think about kind of culture before that, you've got the only information that you're getting as a human is from other living humans.
Yeah.
Or from the world around you. But the information about humans is coming from other living humans. Once you get the written word, you can obviously read the thoughts of somebody who you've never met.
Yes.
And that person may not even be alive anymore. And that is, when you think about it, that is actually quite mind-blowing.
It's also mind-blowing to think that wasn't the case for so long.
Yeah,
you forget about that, don't you?
Yeah,
just the ability
you do.
To communicate outside your tribe and outside your own experience.
Yeah. So it's only 4,000 years that we've been able to do that, to kind of have that kind of information that gets passed on.
Yeah.
That can be centuries old or thousands of years old.
Yeah.
And I suppose if you look at what's happened with the written word, then, some of it is that I think a lot of history tends to be about prominent people and, big political changes always written about from the point of view of the victors. And you've got a lot of people's stories that never get written down.
Yeah.
I think a big change came with probably novel writing. And, that the idea of a novel that you can get inside somebody else's head and experience a different world from the perspective of another individual.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean,
it really is.
It kind of enlarges our own human experience, I think.
Yeah, I mean, when I was, and I knew I was going to speak to you, I was looking at all your areas of your work and I felt like this feeling of like, oh, this is actually quite overwhelming. It's like once you start peering in, it's sort of endless. It's like looking at space or like the sea or something. It's like, whoa, okay, I'm just going to try and cram for a brief history of everything that humans have been up to. But talking about getting your information from other humans, before we started recording, we were talking about the fact you have two kids and how you find that really fascinating, just watching them grow up. So now are they, is it 10 and 12, is that right?
10 and 13.
Now. Okay, cool.
Yeah, right, I've got a teenager. Yeah.
I know, it's quite a milestone that, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
I think it's because everybody's got such a strong association with their own teenage years. You're like, whoa, here we go. You start 13 is like such a it's like a gentle little start, but woo, here we go.
And you kind of go, that's when you first start to find out who you really are as a person as well, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And everything's firing and, the neurological remapping and everything that's going on is quite, it's a good area of research for you. You really enjoy that. If we go back to what was happening in your life when you had your first baby.
Oh my goodness, that was a crazy year. It was a crazy, crazy year. I'd left Bristol University, so I'd resigned from my academic job. I'd been there for 11 years and I'd started to, I suppose, do other things. So I'd started, by that point, I was already doing quite a bit of television. I'd had my first big landmark series on the BBC. We filmed that in 2008. That was Incredible Human Journey,
mm-hmm.
where we went around the world mapping Paleolithic migration, so the kind of colonisation of the world in the Ice Age.
Wow. And just to hold on that for a second, how did you find that going into TV? Because, you know, you didn't have to broach into telly if you'd wanted just to stay
yeah.
in the research, I guess.
Oh,
I
no, mean, that was a, so that was another mistake, really. So having become a lecturer at Bristol University and, teaching anatomy, doing my research in old bones, it was the research in old bones that ended up opening the world of television to me, because I was doing some work, I was doing my own research, but also doing writing reports on bones
mm-hmm.
for the police occasionally, getting involved with forensic cases, and then also for archaeologists.
Mm-hmm.
So people would dig up bones in Bristol and they'd send them up to our labs at the university, and there was a team of us there writing up the reports on these bones.
So you really were doing like modern day and back, and it's all across the ages when you're looking at the
analyzing
bones.
Yeah.
Wow, that must have been interesting.
And then Tyne team were half based in Bristol, and they needed somebody to do reports for them. So they, you know, they had to produce reports on all of their excavations. So they got in touch with the team at Bristol University and said, will you do reports for us? So that's how I started. So I was literally getting the bones that they'd dug up on whatever site and writing those reports. And then they said, well, can you come along on one of these shoots? And I said, well, I have to reorganise my teaching a bit. So are you sure that there's going to be bones? And they said...
I'm not coming if there's no bones.
Exactly. There's no point in me coming. And they said, well, it's a cemetery excavation. So I was like, all right.
It's fairly likely.
Okay. So I went along. And that's kind of a standard way in which academics engage with the media and the media engages with academics, that you have expert contributors. So
yeah.
that was kind of my role. And it just kind of grew, and it grew quite organically. So I ended up doing a little bit of presenting, interviewing people. And then the BBC invited me to present Coast. And I think they thought I was an archaeologist. So I had to say, when they said, we'd quite like you to present this programme, I was like, I'm not really a presenter. I've never done a piece to camera before. And also, I think you think I'm an archaeologist, and I'm not. And they said, what are you? And I said, I'm a biological anthropologist. And they were like, oh, all right.
That's reassuring that they had to start from the same place I was a few days ago. That's right.
So I ended up doing more and more television and really enjoying that. So I got to the point with my job at Bristol where I don't know whether it was necessarily difficult to balance all of those things, but certainly I had the view that the university wasn't particularly supportive of people doing public engagement, and I must say I did feel as though my head was pressed up against a bit of a glass ceiling. So I'd been there 11 years and I did see quite a lot of men being promoted around me and wondered why it wasn't the same for me.
Mm.
And so there were lots of things, and I just got to the point where I thought, I'm not enjoying this job as much as I was. So I resigned in 2009, and literally 2 weeks after I handed in my letter of resignation, I discovered I was pregnant.
Oh.
So that was a big thing.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, I'm leaving a really secure job here.
Yeah.
And stepping out. And it felt like stepping off a precipice into the unknown. You know, I'd worked for the NHS full-time. I'd worked for the University of Bristol full-time.
Yeah.
And I was suddenly stepping off into what I hoped might be the world of freelancing. And you just don't know when you step off if there's going to be anything to step onto.
Yeah.
So it was a bit tricky. And when I left the university, I had a book to write. So I was writing a big anatomy book at the time. And then the prospect of a television series came up, and it was a series looking at British archaeology, travelling around. And it sounded really exciting. It was a new idea, new television series. But, I had to say to the producers, look, I'd love to do it, but I'm going to have a baby next February. And amazingly, John Farron, who is the executive producer, said, okay, well, how about if we start filming in April and you bring your baby with you?
Wow. So that's actually pretty...
That's what I did.
That's pretty amazing response, though, because if they hadn't said that, how do you think you would have fought your corner to try and make it happen? Or do you think you would have just gone, okay, yeah, no, I can see why that's not going to work? Like, how significant is it that they tried to work around you?
Yeah, really significant, because I didn't know. I had my lovely friend Miranda Krestovnikov, who was one of the presenters on Coast and does a lot of wildlife presenting. I knew that, so her kids are a little bit older than mine, and I knew that she had taken her babies filming with her.
Mm.
So before I talked to the producers about it, I went around and had a proper chat with Ms about how it was, mm-hmm. and, you know, how difficult it was, whether she would recommend it, whether she thought, you know, I'd be able to do it. And she said, yeah, just, you know, it's fine. They're very portable.
Agreed. That's an adjective I use a lot when they're small.
As long as you've got somebody with you. So my husband was also just kind of embarked on a freelance career at that point as well. And he said, look, I'm going to support you this year. I'm going to come with you filming. So that's how we did it. But yeah, I mean, I think the producers of Digging, and John Farron in particular, he was absolutely wonderful, because he said, look, we'll try this. And if it doesn't work, it's fine. You can walk away from it. And if it doesn't work, to just have you as the single presenter, we could maybe bring in another presenter. Let's just see what happens.
That's pretty amazing.
I mean, that was amazing, because it meant that I was going into it without that kind of stress of going, oh my goodness, what if this doesn't work?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because it could have just as easily been someone saying, we can make it April and hopefully that'll just be fine. And it's kind of on you to make it fine.
Yeah.
And then you'd feel all that pressure of, okay, I think I can probably do this, but what if I can't? And you get that slightly jangly adrenaline of just like, have I bitten off more than I can chew with this? So to have him say, let's just feel our way with it. This is a new thing for you, a new thing for us.
Yeah.
And then you've got that slight blissful ignorance, I think, as well, when it's your first baby, because people, your friends saying, it's fine. You go, okay, yeah, nodding with them. Yeah, fine. But you don't really, it's so hard to imagine. It's so abstract.
It's nuts, isn't it?
When they're actually here. Yeah. And how are you going to feel? And you're going to feel the same person you were before you had them. Because I know when I was having my first, I was really worried that all of my priorities would flip to the extent where I didn't even know, am I still going to be ambitious? Am I still going to want to do things with my work like that?
Yeah.
I don't know how I'll feel. Also, your brain isn't necessarily super sharp when you've got all the hormones and the sleep deprivation.
There's an element of wading through treacle, isn't there? In your mind, trying to...
I mean, the cruelty of not sleeping properly is tough on your brain. It's just that feeling. Like, I do know more than four words. I just can't think of any of them right now. It's just everything is gone.
I felt as though I had amazing training for babies, having been a junior doctor in the 90s.
Well, touching on that for a minute... Is it true you did some of your ward rounds in rollerblades?
Yes, it is.
That's bloody cool.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
You must have been a memorable junior doctor. Can I see the one in the rollerblades, please?
Yeah. Towards the end of university that got into rollerblading. We used to go rollerblading around Cathays Park in the middle of Cardiff.
I have rollerblades. Brilliant fun.
They're just fantastic. I've rediscovered them recently.
Have you?
My kids are into rollerblading.
Oh, and good for you.
So I got myself some really nice ones because I could only find one of my ones from university. I went up in the loft and I've managed to find one of them.
Mm-mm.
But it was so battered. I'll get myself some more. But yeah, so I was doing paediatrics and paediatric surgery, actually, when I was a house officer. And when you were on call overnight, you'd be sleeping in the accommodation on site at the hospital.
Mm.
But it was still some distance away from the main hospital. And there were these tunnels underground that you went through to get from the accommodation to the hospital. And I was like, well, this is perfect. I can get quickly through those tunnels if I take my rollerblades. So I did that. And then I thought, actually, I probably could do... I mean, I don't think you'd do it now, would you? But probably could do my ward round on rollerblades. But yeah, it was paediatrics and the kids absolutely loved it.
I bet they did.
Oh.
That's very cute. Anyway, sorry, I went off on a bit of a tangent there, but I did think that was a really amazing thing about you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So let's cut back. So you've had your baby and then you find yourself with an 8-week-old going off to farm.
Yeah.
And what are your memories of that time now?
Oh, really lovely memories. It was really lovely. It was really joyful. I was working with a really fantastic team, you know, lovely, lovely crew. We'd stay in places and we'd all have dinner together, and quite often some guitars would come out in the evening and people would be playing music. It was just lovely. It was a really precious time being together as a little family as well.
Yeah.
So my husband would take my daughter when I was actually, you know, on camera and filming, and then we'd have to try and hook up at lunchtime so that I could feed her, because I was like, she's going to be breastfed. That's going to happen. What I'd also done, having talked to Miranda, was made sure that she would have bottles as well. So I was expressing milk so that if we didn't quite get the timing right, we could manage all of that. So she was only getting breast milk, but she was doing bottle feeding as well as breastfeeding. And that was funny because these conversations with the health visitor, who I think was quite disapproving of me introducing a bottle early on, given that my daughter was, I mean, she was brilliant at breastfeeding. I didn't have any issues at all with breastfeeding. It was absolute joy. Mm. She just knew what to do and got on with it. I was like, thank goodness she knows what to do. And I remember the health visitor being like, ooh, you know, she could get nipple confusion. And I was like, what? I'm sorry, what is this thing?
I know, it's brilliant, isn't it? All the terms.
Nipple confusion. This idea that if you introduce them to a bottle, they're then going to go, what's that thing? I'm not going to go back to drinking it out of a breast. But it turned out that she was quite happy with, you know, whatever it was, as long as it had milk coming out of it.
Even if she was confused, she was just open to either method.
Oh dear.
I know, I love all those terms they come up with. And they're sort of there to make you feel terrible. The idea of a confused week old, I've confused you already. You're so new and you're already confused.
Yeah, what am I doing to you? Oh my goodness, it was so, I mean, it's funny though. It was, and this, you know, it's like television is so unglamorous at times. I remember being in a taxi with one of the crew going across London, and I just had got to the point where I had to express some milk. And you get to the point where it hurts. And I'm actually just going to have to express the milk. So I was basically under a shawl in the back of a taxi going across London with my electric breast pumps going. Yeah. So that was the kind of glamour of filming with a baby and so.
I had a rucksack because I had my second baby around the same time as your first baby, so 2009. And by that time, for the first baby, I'd had to use this sort of hospital-grade single breast pump thing because both my babies were born early, those two. So the breast pump is the only way you can do any milk if that's what you want to do, because they can't suck when they're really little. But by the time I got to Kit in 2009, they'd come up with all sorts of amazing breast pumps, including this one that fit in a rucksack with a double pump attachment.
Oh my goodness, you could walk around with it.
Yeah, I think they called it Pump and Go. I mean, it was pretty snazzy, let me tell you.
That's hilarious.
So yeah, I got very yeah, used to that. I've definitely, back of a taxi, 100%. I've been there, under the sheet.
And
it's just the noise sometimes.
Did you carry on working all the way through then when you had little kids?
I sort of did different things with different ones, really. Yeah. I think I'd been releasing a second album when I found out I was pregnant with my first baby, which was sort of comedically, you know, weird timing. So I did two singles and then basically just stopped the album. I didn't do any more promotion with it. And as it turned out, that was quite good timing because he ended up being born early. I wasn't very well, so I kind of focused on that for a little bit. And then I gradually worked my way back into songwriting, but it was gentle and I didn't have anything in the diary. So I sort of took my longest with him. But by the time I got to some of the later babies, the sequels, I was a lot faster at getting back into work because I felt like I had a bit more of my own mind about how I wanted it to take shape and what it felt like. And certainly by the time I got to baby 4 and 5, I was working, but it felt very supportive. It felt very wholesome. I liked being in a music environment with a tiny baby. It felt actually very harmonious and I enjoyed it a lot. And it also meant that I had proper time with that new baby where I still had my little ones, but I could kind of go to work, but actually have time with my baby, just the two of us. Otherwise, I don't think I would have had as much time. The only one I sort of think I got a bit wrong with, really my second, in that I was in hospital having again had him 2 months early, and my manager came to see me and he said, so we're going to film a video for this new single in 10 weeks. And I was like, okay. And really, I think filming a music video 10 weeks after my second C-section was just a bit, heels, mini skirt, makeup.
Oh, no.
I just wasn't in that mood, actually.
No, not at all.
So that was the only one where I think I probably should have said no to that. But I think you just have to, I think you'd have to go with the support of the people who tell you the nice advice that makes you feel like you're doing the right thing. Because those voices and that support is like, became like everything to me. And stay away from Mumsnet forums and places like that. Because I remember going to work one time, I had one gig with when it was my third, he was 6 weeks. And it meant a night away from him, which made me feel, it was like that thing of like Velcro.
Oh, it's awful, isn't it? Away. You can literally feel this kind of, this kind of weird umbilical cord still there.
Exactly. I felt terrible. And so I was Googling, you know, is it okay to leave my baby for one night? And it was all these people on forums going, well, I mean, you can. Personally, I wouldn't. It wouldn't be for me. But I mean, you could if you want.
You might scar them for life.
If you don't mind that your baby won't have you for a night when it's... And it was just, you know, not the place to head for advice. But I think with you and what you're doing, and when you say it was a really lovely time and really joyful and lovely to look back on, I think it's really special, actually, that you get that experience. And also, with what you were up to, it kind of meant forever after that point, you had this sort of blueprint of, I know I've done this version of my working with my baby and my husband.
Yeah.
So therefore, I know I'm capable. So then the decisions I make, I don't need to test myself in any environment. I know what works for me. I've done it in a safe way. And then from there on, you can kind of just keep going. And I suppose early on, it meant that you still had the passion that you have for your work was all still there. It was sort of still entwined with that new chapter, especially after finding out that you were having a baby at just 2 weeks after handing in your resignation. Because at that point, you probably thought, okay, deep breath, you know, what happens
absolutely.
Next?
Absolutely.
And did you do it a similar way when you had your second?
No, because I had... Because then my daughter was 3.5 and it would have been, I think, too difficult to do a similar thing with a tiny baby and a 3.5-year-old.
Yeah, it's definitely different.
You're being dragged in two different directions, aren't you?
Yeah, they're not so portable, the 3.5.
They're not so portable, no. And they, you know, you end up running after them.
Yeah.
So I decided to, by that time, I was working at Birmingham University. So having thought, actually, when I left Bristol, I was very disillusioned with lots of things, but I thought I'd probably left academia for good as a, you know, in a kind of formal role. I had honorary positions at a couple of universities, including at the archaeology department in Bristol, where I had just amazing friends and incredibly supportive people. Including my very good friend and PhD supervisor, Kate, who is, you know, still just such an amazing woman and really, really helped me at that difficult time. I think that I'd thought I'd left academia, and then the University of Birmingham was interested in my work in public engagement, mm-hmm. which is broader than the television stuff, which is obviously the most visible bit. But I'd also done quite a lot in schools engagement and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so they were talking to me about a job, and I was quite reluctant to begin with. But I joined the university in 2012, and I'm still at Birmingham University, and that's been amazing. I mean, I absolutely loved that job. So I was in a university role as well as doing writing and broadcasting. And then I'm pregnant with my second baby, and I decided to take time out. So I took 9 months off. Well, I kind of took time out. I took 9 months off from the university, mm. and I took 9 months off from television. Quite a difficult thing to do, actually, because there were quite a few projects that year where people were saying, oh, you could do this. And there were some really interesting projects. I was like, I'm not doing it. I've made this decision. I'm going to stick with it.
And how easy was it to say no to things then? Did you feel, was it a bit of a wobble, or were you like, no, I know what I need now?
I think it was quite difficult, but I did stick to my guns. And my husband and I always talk about balance and work and life and family, and you know, we were kind of discussing these opportunities, and I thought, you know, that it's that thing with television where you realize if you turn down something, it probably is not going to come back. Mm-hmm. And you kind of worry about where your career is going to go in the future. So I think, as a freelancer, you've always got that thing of going, oh, is that, have I stepped off something here?
Yeah.
And is it going to be really difficult to get back on again? But I've made that decision. And I was writing a book as well. So that's what I did keep doing. I kept on writing. And I found that really important, actually, when I had little babies, that I was still doing something with my mind. Because I talked to some people who said, I'm not even sure if they meant it, but they say, oh, you know, for a while, all you want to think about is nappies and bottles and things like this. And I was thinking, this sounds like hell to me. No, that's not what nappies. I want to do. I'm still me. Yeah. I'm still, you know, I'm not just a...
No, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think, you know, that new baby bit, if you have that time without, I mean, maybe they didn't mean literally nappies. I've got a very literal mind. But
yeah.
I suppose if you are just...
Isn't the nicest thing about having a baby, is it?
I wouldn't say so. No. But I do think, you know, sometimes those bits where they've got a little baby, it is really extraordinary, you know, and it feels quite special. But, I mean, look, it's each to their own, isn't it? But I think if you've got quite a busy brain, it can be quite nice to feel like you've got another place to go and other things to talk about sometimes.
Yeah.
It doesn't even have to be work things. I think even now that you can do things like... go to the cinema. You know, they do all those mornings where you can go to the pictures and you can bring your baby.
Yeah.
So you can actually just watch a film that other... So when you see your friends, you've got other things, something else to talk about.
Yes.
It's just... Well, I always quite like that feeling. But yeah.
I mean, so it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's obviously the biggest thing that's happening in your life at that point in time when you've got a child.
Mm.
And a new, you know, a new baby. It is amazing. It's extraordinary. It's lovely. Mm. But... I didn't want to lose the rest of myself. So, yeah, writing a book was quite important to be doing. Although, having said that, so my daughter, who was the baby that came on the first series of Digging for Britain and the second series of Digging for Britain, mm-hmm. Was just very, very amenable to going around the country, sleeping anywhere, just an extraordinarily calm little baby. And she slept a lot, and my husband and I were congratulating ourselves on being, you know, very relaxed parents, and obviously this was why she was the way she was. And then the next one came along and he was completely different.
Yeah.
And he did not sleep in the night. He woke up every hour and a half through the night, and he did not sleep during the day at all. So I was trying to write this book.
Yeah.
Whilst, you know, kind of almost, you know, propping my eyes open.
Wow. I mean, I have to say, that's still extraordinary. You say you're not really working, but you did write a book. I mean, that is a massive achievement in itself, definitely.
It was a difficult book as well. It was
a lot of long words.
long was it? It was a book I'd wanted to write for ages, and it was kind of very apt because it was about embryology. So it was about development in utero and kind of starting off from the single cell, which I just think is, I do still think it's the best story in the world. How you get from being a single tiny cell to being a whole person. It's completely crazy.
Yeah, and it's mind-blowing, actually.
It is absolutely mind-blowing that each of us did this thing. We were just a cell, just one cell. It's mad.
That is.
And I teach, I've taught embryology at medical school since I started in academia. I've always loved embryology. And it kind of explains the anatomy. It's kind of where the anatomy comes from as well. So I was like, I really want to write a book about this because the stories are brilliant. You only really get to understand that stuff and to hear those stories if you study medicine or biology at university. So I wanted to write something that was more accessible. And also embryology is kind of where evolution happens. So it's where the body gets built. And so if you're going to end up with species evolving and changes happening over time, it's happening through that building process. So evolution and embryology are intertwined. So that was the book I wanted to write. I remember talking to my lovely literary agent, Luigi, about it, and he was a bit sceptical at first, but I was very passionate about the subject. But I think I did go away from some conversations with him thinking, well, I'm hoping to write a popular science book, but this could be the most unpopular science book that anybody's ever written. But it was tricky, I think, because I'd set myself that kind of challenge of writing about the two things together, both embryology and evolution. But I think in the way that some of those most challenging things that you set yourself can be a nightmare at times, and you're just going, oh, I'm just thinking, why have I done this to myself? Why have I set myself this challenge? But then what you end up with at the end is just really satisfying.
But, and then you can't even put yourself back in the mindset of how you got there in the first place. Like, how did I do it? Or where did the time come from?
Yeah.
You just know you did it. But I'm wondering, what's the link between your day job, if you're looking at anatomy and anthropology and behaviour, and then what's your relationship with it when you're just with your family and seeing a small human turning into a big human? I mean, does it have a lot of crossover, or do you not really think of, I mean, like, when you look at people, do you see like their bones? You look at it, does it cross over?
Yeah, I think so. And certainly with children, I mean, being someone that's really interested in development, then, looking at children as they grow. And it's interesting, obviously, how their bodies change and how they change shape and change size. And, that's all extraordinary.
Yeah.
Going back to when they were babies, I always used to, you've got this baby that you've made in quite a meaningful way, in that that baby started off as a single cell, and then essentially my husband contributed a tiny bit of DNA to that first single cell, and then everything else that creates the baby that you give birth to has come from you. So you've actually created, it's done it itself, but it's done it using materials that you're giving it.
Yeah.
So all of the material that goes into making that baby has come from your own body. I found that really intriguing.
Wow, yeah, that is actually amazing, isn't it?
And then you go, and then it carries on, of course, when you're feeding the baby.
Yeah.
Because again, all the growth of that baby is being fueled by what you're giving that baby from your own body. And I mean,
you don't really
that.
Think of it that way, because you think of it as a process, and then that thing is just doing what it does.
But obviously you're providing all the materials. All those materials have come from you getting stuff out of your environment, eating your environment, and then giving it back to your baby in a form that they can use. And I quite like that. I quite like going, and I'm now going to do this magic trick of eating this cake and making it into milk.
Well, I'm going to sit my children down going, you owe everything to me.
Yes, yeah. I mean, obviously, up until the point they start to eat stuff, if you're breastfeeding them, then everything that's in their body has come from you, which is quite nuts.
That is nuts.
So I've had those kind of thoughts going.
Yeah.
And I think, also, in terms of embryology and evolution, when I had my daughter, I don't know if it was, you know, I think childbirth is such an incredible time.
Mm.
You know, this. I think when I had my first baby, I had this complete mental wall in my head of me as a woman with a baby inside me. And then on the other side of that wall, as me with a baby that's external. And I couldn't really, even though I'm an anatomist and I've been, you know, a medic as well, I know the physical reality of it, but just trying to get your head around the fact that there's going to be this new person and that somehow the bump, which is, you know, not just a bump, it's a, you can feel that person inside you, but the idea that that person's suddenly going to be on the outside of you is such a, I mean, until you've done it, I think with the second baby, you go, yeah, I understand how this happens now. But do you know what I mean? It's kind of understanding it not in a physical way, but in a kind of intuitive way.
Yeah, no, I think
really it, weird.
Until they're there, it's almost impossible to really sort of make that an actual.
Yeah.
Because also there's so many bits of it. I don't know, this might just be my experience, but when they're born, it's almost like that's when you meet them. So you've had the relationship of the bit when it's the two of you in the symbiosis, but then there's this sort of extra bit that when you see them, you go, oh, of course it's you.
Yeah.
And it's the bit you didn't know about them, but you sort of felt on another level.
Yeah.
You can't draw that out until they're there.
No. Even that amazing thing of being able to see your babies in the womb, which is, I mean, that's another extraordinary bit of technology, isn't it? If we think about human experiences, the fact that it's only in the last sort of 50, 60 years that we've had that, that anybody's actually been able to see their baby before they're born.
Yes.
And that now we've got ultrasounds and not just, you know, you can see them in three dimensions and you can see them moving in three dimensions. And that's incredible. But it's still something completely different when you see them face to face for the first time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, those 3D ones where they can see more of the features might have come on there, but I never did those because I saw the pictures that they sort of used to advertise to me always looked like a baby made of clay or something. And I thought, I don't know. I think I'll just wait.
I had 4D scans for both my babies and they were pretty good.
Really?
But yeah. I mean, when you look at them and you can compare the baby with the scan, you go, that is pretty good.
Yeah, that's
But they do look weird. Yeah. They look kind of slightly metallic.
Yeah, well, I only remember it really with my first. I mean, that's like nearly 20 years ago and everything moves on at such a pace.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that this is, there's something I saw about the way you were raising your daughter and it really resonated with me because you were talking about the fact that you didn't want her to feel that she had to conform to sort of stereotypical girl things. And I felt this very strongly with my first as well and have continued to because I've happened to have had boys. But I was really shocked at the sort of the things that were expected of him just because he happened to be a boy that I didn't even know if he was into yet. And I want to talk to you about that because I don't really feel like I see that many people talking about it the way I feel about it as well, actually. I don't know if that's because a lot of people are just quite happy with the way things go in a predictable way, or maybe people don't feel the need to get annoyed about it. I get annoyed about it still. Like if I go into, there's a clothes shop not far from here and they've got like a boy's side and a girl's side with the clothes and the boys will say certain slogans and the girls... I remember saying it to one of the poor girls, members of staff in there the other day, like, do you not think they're kind of expecting different things? And she was a bit like, she did it blank. I don't think she knew what to do with me, really. But I just wondered where that came from, that feeling. Was it just because you met your daughter and thought, let's see who you are? Or was it because of like external, you know, when you're shopping for them or you take them to nursery and the expectation or?
I think it came from a number of different routes. I mean, I think it's, it suddenly becomes very personal when you have a child and you're thinking about how you want them to experience the world. And I felt quite strongly that I didn't want to be narrowing horizons, that I wanted her and my son to be able to engage with the world and not to have those kind of cultural expectations.
Yeah.
But even before I had children, I was interested in, for instance, the lack of girls and women in the more physical sciences, and you know, still in engineering, so few professional engineers a women. It's just extraordinary. And, you know, sometimes you hear opinions, and still today, you know, still quite recently, you hear people saying, oh, well, that's because boys are better at such and such, or that's because girls are, you know, more attuned to such and such. And you think, I don't actually believe that. I think it is largely cultural. Because you, if you went back to the 1940s, 1950s and looked at medicine, you'd say, oh, well, the reason that most doctors are men is because men are better suited to being doctors. And clearly, something's happened in medicine, which means that girls can aspire to be doctors. And, you know, when you open it up in that way, and it's about a culture change, isn't it? You find that actually lots of girls do want to become doctors. So we've seen that big change happening in medicine. We've seen it happening in biology as well. It's happening in chemistry, but I still think there's big issues with physics and engineering. I think it is entirely cultural. I don't think there's anything about male brains that means that men are better at physics or more attuned to physics and girls and women are not.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
So there's that kind of perspective, and I think that, you know, that all there have been lots of efforts, obviously, to try to open up those areas of science, and we've seen a small increase, but it's still, you know, we've still got a long way to go, I think. There's something ethical about it, which is that you don't want to be limiting people's horizons. You don't want to be limiting people's opportunities.
No, and it's such a strain when you have your child and then you see, as you say, these sort of limitations put on them. It's such a instinct, isn't it, to push back on that and go, well, no, can they not just have the option of whatever makes that works for them, please?
Yeah.
Like, why are you sort of diminishing their choices? It felt like a very, very old school, actually. I was really surprised at that, as you know, that they would just be like, well, I presume you're going to want things from this side of the chart. But I guess probably with me having a son, my instinct was probably more to do with, I don't know, how he chooses to be in his character and his emotional language and all those kinds of things. Because I guess you don't tend to worry about, as you say, boys having the option of the jobs they want, because there's such a broad selection of very, you know, high profile men in all of those areas. So you're not, so it's more probably the emotional support I wanted to offer.
Yeah.
And let them be.
Well, I think it works the same. So there are subjects where, like psychology, where that's very female dominated.
Yeah, you're expected to be empathetic and men to be less so, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very true, actually. And it's, I mean, it's nice that there are some increases, but really I think we can ramp things up a little bit and go a bit quicker. And I suppose, I mean, do you think about the fact that the work you've been doing and being a communicator on such a broad platform has maybe helped more women and young girls see a life for themselves in the sciences you care about?
It's absolutely lovely to, you know, I get emails and letters from children and young people saying, you know, they've watched something that I've made, or they've read something that I've written, and that's helped them kind of think about what they might want to be doing in the future. And I like doing live shows as well and sort of chatting to the audience afterwards, and it's lovely to have that kind of feedback from people. And I think it's kind of an overused word, but I think it's really humbling. And I think that I'm lucky to be doing that. I'm lucky to be in that position where I can kind of be there as a woman doing the science that I love doing, talking about it, writing about it. And I hope it helps a bit.
No, I think it definitely does. I guess it's something that when you're just doing what you do, you sort of don't think about that as like the concentric circles. And then when you realise it, it's like, oh, that's a really lovely extra thing that I'm doing, the thing I care about. I've got, you know, all these great opportunities, and also it's reaching people.
Yeah.
It's a really nice thing.
It is. And also I think it makes you very aware that it's really important to have all sorts of different role models.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I think by and large, the BBC does a really good job of that, of making sure that there is a diversity in terms of just the people that you can see. on television, and particularly in documentaries, when you're looking at people who are, you know, talking about history or science or whatever it is.
Yeah.
To see a diversity of people doing those subjects, I think, is incredibly important.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as it should be. And I'm glad that if that's been a conscious decision, then I'm really...
Yeah, it is a conscious decision, and it's really important.
It is, definitely. Yeah. And it also brings it to life and makes everybody... It sort of makes the conversations flow more easy, because you realise that actually you don't have to look a certain type of person to be open about the passions you have, you know. Yeah. It's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to speak to you about is, I don't know, recently you were on a Radio 4 programme that was touching on your work as in the Humanists, and my mum was on the same programme, because she's a member of Humanist UK, and you're, is it vice president still? Do you still work with them?
You get to be, so I was president for 4 years, and then after you're president, you get to be vice president for life.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you get a nice badge?
There's quite a few. I don't think I've got a badge, actually. I should ask about that. Yeah.
Some sort of rosettes.
Yeah.
But actually, I think the Humanist thing is really interesting, and I'm sure that is exactly the same as my beliefs as well, because I like, what I like about it is it's not about the absence thing. So it's not about saying I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God, or I'm agnostic, I don't believe in any religion. You're actually saying, well, of course you have to believe in those, feel like that in order to be a humanist, but you're actually saying about, I suppose, humans being able to find their own purpose in life,
sort
of believing in a value of the fact that we do exist and we're here and this is our one life and let's see if we can make it. Is that something that was very influenced by what you do and the connection you have with the stories of that the bones tell you, or is that something that was just always there?
I think, is it really interesting, because I didn't hear it. Or I don't say I hadn't heard of humanism. I might have kind of heard about it, but I didn't realise that it described what I thought until probably 25 years ago, maybe. So it was quite, I was an adult, and I knew I didn't believe in God, but I didn't feel that kind of defined me.
Mm.
You know, it is odd, isn't it, to define yourself by something that you're not.
Yeah, and also that sounds...
So it's like
very,
I'm a
negative,
non-
and it doesn't mean you're not actually still. There's so much beauty and wonder in the world. It doesn't mean you want to have something that shows you're still taking all of that in, and however that might feel for someone that has that kind of faith, it's still got a spirituality to it. It's still part.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've said that before, and I've said, you know, I consider myself to be quite a spiritual person, and then some religious people say you're not spiritual because you're not religious, and it's like, I don't think you get to tell somebody whether they feel spiritual or not.
No, no, and if things move you, like nature and
people,
music and poetry and art and all these things, they contribute. They inform. They are extra. They are part of, you know, all the tapestry that being alive is about. And it's nice to be able to have a way to contextualise that.
Yeah, and that it's so it's kind of there's a scientific basis for me, in that I was brought up in quite a religious household, and I got to the point where I was a teenager and thinking, I was doing sciences at school and just thinking, I can't really match this up in my mind, this doesn't work.
Mm.
And so I decided when I was a teenager that I didn't believe in God. And then I kind of just left that, I suppose, and didn't feel that there was a need to attach myself to any particular philosophy or to describe it in any particular way, until I started to read a bit more about humanism. I think it was talking to Jim Al-Khalili, actually, because he's a good friend, and we'd worked at Cheltenham Science Festival together over years, and I knew that he was involved with Humanist UK, and we talked about humanism, and I thought, actually, that probably does describe what I think, which is that you've got a rational approach to the world and you kind of prioritise that, but also you've got a strong sense of values and morals and ethics, and that you have, your own kind of moral sense is guided by, certainly by reason.
Mm-hmm.
And logic. I mean, I think there's a fantastic logic about equality, that there's no logical reason for any one human to be worth any more than any other human. So therefore, equality.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very logical and rational. But then empathy and, kindness, I think, as a principle in life is really important to me.
Yeah,
so I love it brings that. All of that together. And I think, you know, that's what humanism is. And you don't have to, I think there's a lot of people that feel that way, but would still feel nervous about labelling themselves as anything.
Because it's not,
it's not like organised religion where you have to kind of sign up to something. And no. Say, you know, this is what I believe.
I think also having gone to, I didn't grow up in a religious house at all, but I did go to church school. My local state school was church school. So between the ages of like 4 and 11. And I think there's still a part of me that thinks if I voice these things, then I might still be hit by lightning, even though I don't actually believe that's possible. Do you know what I mean? Sort of like, it's just like a childlike emotion between, you know, my adult brain and the things I believe in, and then the fact if I vocalise it. But I'm always a bit like,
I think that's quite damaging. And I think that's one of the reasons that I started supporting Humanist UK was because it's a nice bunch of people with similar kind of ideas to mine. But actually I think there's work to be done in our society. There's work to be done to stop the religious privilege that still exists, which is a kind of historical artifact. You know, the fact that we've got religious clerics with automatic seats in government in the House of Lords is crazy. You know, you've got 26 Anglican bishops who get automatic seats in the House of Lords. So things like that, we just think doesn't fit our society, actually.
No, there's probably so much about the way that things are set up. This is throwback and handed down. Nobody's looking at the books and going,
hang on a minute.
Can I just point this out? Are you aware of this?
Yeah.
sounds a bit old-fashioned nowadays.
Only two countries in the world where you've got religious clerics with automatic seats in government, Iran and the UK. Yeah, when you put it like that, it's mad.
Wow.
It's mad. And then I think I feel the same way about faith schools. So so I've worked with Humanist UK on that whole kind of issue because, I mean, for me, when I was first looking for schools for my children, it became very obvious that basically I had no choice and I was going to end up sending my children to a faith school.
Mm.
Because a third of our primary schools are faith schools.
A third?
A third. I know, it's crazy. So Humanist UK have this kind of ongoing campaign about that. And it's not about being anti-religious and it's not about attacking anybody's individual faith or religion.
Yeah.
It's about saying state schools shouldn't be pushing a particular religion onto children. And they definitely do. So having had children that have gone to faith schools, even if I, you know, as a humanist parent went along and, you know, talked to them and said, look, please, could you not tell them to pray? Please, could you invite them to pray if they want to, or to, you know, to meditate on something rather than telling them about God as a fact?
Yeah.
And getting them to imagine God as a fact, it would still just happen. It just kind of permeated it. And I think, you know, I went to a C of E school as well, and these ideas get kind of lodged. There was a point with me where I found it all quite difficult because I'd recently lost my mother-in-law and we just had to have our dog put down as well. And my daughter, who was quite little at the time, was just, you know, she wasn't completely confused about it. We talked about everything. But, you know, she was being told that somebody had come back to life. So she knew this story about Jesus coming back to life and that he'd been crucified. She knew that he'd had nails through his hands as well, which I think is quite a traumatic thing to tell children.
Yeah.
But then she was saying, you know, she was asking if other people could come back to life. So you've kind of introduced these very weird and I think deeply unhelpful ideas to children.
Well, also, if you believe in that, then you can have that as how your house operates. But if you don't, then you've got quite a tricky bit of, I mean, you don't want to undermine school and then telling them things, but at the same time, you don't think what they're telling them is true.
Yeah.
And you say it's not about, I would never want to take away anyone's faith. In fact, I'm actually sometimes quite jealous of people who've got it and it means so much to them and has helped them through difficult things or gives them that perspective. I think that's magic, actually. I think it's wonderful. But you're just looking for the option that works for you when you're raising your child. And I didn't realise it's as many as a third of schools, because you also get the people where they go to church just to get the place in the school. So it's not like we're only talking about catering for that. those families, really.
Yeah. No, I think they're really divisive. There's an interesting group called the Accord Coalition, which is a group of religious people and humanists. There's at least one ex-bishop in it, who are arguing against state faith schools in our society, because for all sorts of reasons. First of all, because it is actually against the human rights of the child to, you know, children have human rights, and you have a right to freedom of religion, and that means also freedom from religion. You have a right not to have religion forced on you.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, another dimension of it is the divisiveness in society. And if you've got some schools that are selecting, that will create further social division. We can see that. There's good research to show that. So if you create the possibility of a school selecting and doing that beyond just geographic, I mean, even geographic selection creates differences, of course, mm-hmm. it does. But if you've got faith schools, because some of these schools are able to discriminate against people who are not of that religion. So, you know, you've literally got to get a letter from the vicar to get into that school. And this is, you know, taxpayer-funded state schools. It's crazy. It's just discrimination.
Well, yeah, and it also goes on to my other pet topic, which is just that there should be good local schools for all the kids, full stop, actually. I think
it's what any parent wants, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because you also want those schools to be local. Because when I first expressed this, I had people saying to me, oh, well, you know, you should send your children privately. And I was like, well, why should I send my children privately? You know, state schools are meant to be there for everybody. Mm. Oh, well, you should be prepared to drive your child, you know, however far to get them into a school, which isn't a faith school. And I thought, no, that's not it either, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it? And I'm absolutely not asking for there to be humanist schools. I just don't think we should be pushing anything.
Yeah, I mean, you can have lessons that teach about the different faiths in the world and all this kind of thing. We have conversation and if a child got, you know, thinks, oh my God, that sounds like that's something I want to learn more about, then you pursue it. That's absolutely fine. Obviously, if your family are religious and go to church or wherever you go, that's how you're raised. That'll be there anyway. But school maybe not being part of that would make sense probably for... I wouldn't be surprised if it's not the majority of families, actually, but maybe I'm wrong, just in terms of...
I think
it probably is,
actually, because, I mean, every time there's a census, we're seeing a growing number of people saying they're non-religious. The census questions are a little bit skewed because they say, are you, you know, what religion are you? So they kind of assume that you've got a religion.
Yes.
The British Social Attitude Survey, which says, are you religious? More than half of the population has said they're not for, like, the last 10 years. Mm. And... also, it skews into old age brackets as well.
Yeah.
So I'd imagine that it would be even you know, be more than half.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Younger families. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose people with it when it comes to the way that things are set up with so many things in this country, I think people just get a bit nervous when you start talking about reforms and things because they think it sounds like a lot of work and underpin everybody's sort of been through the same system and look, it worked for most of us. That's just the status quo. It just sounds, that's probably where people mostly just kind of go, keep it as it is, it's fine.
Yeah, and I imagine the Church of England is quite keen to keep its control over schools as well. Because, you know, in those faith schools, it has quite a lot of control over the curriculum. It has control over the way that religion is taught and that it's not just learning about religion, but that it is, you know, putting religion out there as in a kind of factual way. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting,
isn't it?
So,
I imagine the C of E would be very keen not to lose its...
Yeah.
Not to lose its primary schools in particular.
Absolutely. Well, there's again, another whole conversation we have with that. But if we could go back briefly to Bones, because I did want to ask you, what can you learn from a piece of bone and how small can it go for you to learn those things?
That's a great question. That's a really good question. So as an osteologist, I like to be able to look at whole bones. I can get a lot of information about the age of somebody when they died, whether they're male or female. Pathology, which I'm particularly interested in. So I'm always looking at joints to see if I can see evidence of arthritis and that kind of thing. I have worked on cremations, which are really interesting. because
it must be time consuming trying to.
It's very time consuming.
I think I found another bit.
Yeah, I think it requires a kind of patience though. I think when I've got a big collection of cremations that I'm looking at, like I looked at the ones from some Roman cremations from Caerleon in South Wales, and I wrote about them in my last book, Buried. And that was a lot of painstaking work, you know, just picking up tiny pieces of bone with forceps and kind of looking at each one.
I've got my cat's ashes on the mantelpiece over there if you're bored and want to have a go.
But the thing with ashes is really weird, actually, because if you look at archaeological cremations, you've actually got quite big bits of bone. So some of them might be even 2 or 3 centimetres long.
Oh, wow.
And there might be bits of bone that you can recognise. So if you sift through the sample, you might actually end up, well, hopefully being able to, first of all, determine if it was more than one person in a cremation. And if you're really lucky, you might be able to say something about their age and whether they're male or female. So you've got fairly chunky bits of bone, which I think surprises people, because if they do go and pick up ashes of anybody, a pet or a person, it's doesn't seem to be that there'll be any recognisable pieces of bone there. And that's because in modern cremations, we obviously cremate the body. The bones are then, what remains of the bones, these calcined bones, are then taken out of the crematorium and are ground up in a machine called a cremulator. So it's very strange. And I think a lot of people don't know this.
A cremulator.
So I'm fascinated by that, because I think that archaeologists of the future will kind of look back on Britain now and go, it was obviously very important for people to have these bones ground up. There must have been an important belief associated with this grinding up of bones.
Mm.
And yet I think it is something that most people don't know happens.
Wow.
I'm not sure why it happens. Maybe people don't want to collect recognisable pieces of bone
from a
crematorium, that somehow they want to have disappeared the body. The body needs to be disappeared. It's really, I find kind of funerary practices.
Yes.
In the past and today.
Yes.
Quite fascinating.
I have your book. I haven't got to. Yeah. I haven't got to that bit, but I have that. I'm fascinated by it too. Does it make you think about what you want to happen to your bones?
Yeah, I think there's some big ethical questions about that, because,
you've got a bit of a difficult thing to decide, because you might be like, well, I want to go there, study me side of things.
I think I'm going to have to do that. I in my career have depended so heavily on so many anonymous, generous people who left their bodies to medical science, and still do. I think it's the best way to learn anatomy.
Incredible.
Dissection is, it is, it is the best way to understand how the human body is put together, and it's, it's really essential to surgeons in particular to be able to understand that. But I think for all doctors. So yeah, so all these amazingly generous people who
that is very there, generous, isn't
giving
it?
My body to medical science, and they can, they can do that knowing that they've left this incredible gift.
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
To the future. Yeah,
that's extraordinary. Well, if we finish up just about your children again, what do you hope outside? I know we've talked about how we've contributed their physical matter up to the age of whenever you've been there. But what do you hope they've inherited from you more in your character?
Oh, God, that's a big question, isn't it?
It is, actually. Yeah. And I don't know if I'd be able to answer it very well. I'd probably keep changing my answer.
Yeah.
Go with your first instinct, I'd say.
I hope that I'm encouraging them to be kind to people, not to jump to conclusions about people that they meet, but to get to know people and not to be prejudiced. So I think that it's interesting, isn't it? When you think about the biggest thing, and there's so much.
No, but you can't go wrong with a bit of kindness. And actually,
I mean, it's like, I'd love them to be interested in, they're 10 and 13, so I think there's still, for the 10-year-old, the world is still wide open. He's quite interested in various sciences. He's always asking me very difficult questions about physics, which I then have to tweet at Brian Cox. Okay, Brian, can Wilt ask a question like this again? Can you help me, please? Like he asked me the other day, he went, if there's sunshine, if the sun is shining and there are clouds, why aren't there rainbows everywhere? And I was like, okay, this is a great question.
Yeah.
And I kind of think I could probably struggle my way to an answer here.
You could make something up.
And then I'm, yeah, but I can't do that. Honestly, no, he asked me, what's on the other side of a black hole? Was one of his questions.
Oh, that's good.
Which was extraordinary. So, I mean, I love the fact that he's curious and interested in the world. And, you know, my daughter is too. And I love the fact that she's interested in art because I love art.
I know that about you. Yeah, it's another passion.
And there's that kind of nervousness as a parent because you kind of get, when she does a beautiful drawing and there's a bit of me that's like, oh, brilliant, she loves art. And then, you don't want to channel them. I want her to explore freely. And find her thing. They're both really musical, which is amazing because I'm not. So I'm surrounded by people in my house that play music, which is a complete joy. But yeah, I think kindness is the main thing. I think it is, isn't it? It's got to be.
I think kindness definitely is the main thing. And also what you're talking about there with the lack of prejudice and taking people is also about, it comes back to that human connection and the time we're all sharing together, the here and the now. So I think that's a perfect answer. Oh, thank you so much, Alice. That was a complete pleasure. I think we could probably talk about way more. Actually, my youngest, before I let you go, he said something to me last night. I thought it was such funny timing, knowing I was going to speak to you today. So he's four. He was going to sleep and he said, "Mummy, imagine in Sesame Street if Big Bird just stood up and got his bones outside of his body and he was standing there with his bones and his brain and then he collapsed to the floor and his bones all break and he can't get back into being Big Bird again." I was like... Wow, that's outlandish, but I know a lady who can talk to me about bones.
Very metaphysical. Yeah, I'd love to know what Big Bird's skeleton looks like.
I know, in the brain. Fluffy, I expect. See, what a great woman. Thank you, Alice. And it did feel good to think about how I felt about humanism, really. I don't really have a lot of chats about religion these days. It hasn't played a big part in my life, well, really ever. But I definitely, you know, I went to a religious school and it was a big part of the learnings. As it happens, the kids don't go to religious schools. And I don't know how I would have felt about it if they were studying the Bible when it's not part of our lives. And obviously some of the teachings in it, you know, they are presented as fact. It's good to be able to question these things and think about if it works for you. That's not really, they do go to school to try and get a rounded education. And I want them to learn about all religions, but I don't know if I want it to be something where they feel they have to take it on as a truth for themselves, unless it actually resonates. So that's how I feel about it. But also I've thought a lot about that humanist way and about the idea of us all sharing this one experience of life. We happen to all be on the planet at the same time together, about the legacy of kindness and empathy and leaving your mark in the world based on the good deeds you do and, you know, all the stuff that you can leave behind that's positive to do with your work, to do with art, to do with connections with other people. It doesn't have to be a big thing. You don't have to have, you know, designed an amazing building or changed the world. You can just be someone that's thinking about fellow humans and wanting to pitch in and make sure that the world is a little bit better than you found it. I think these are all good things. You know, there's always that adage, isn't there, about people won't remember what you said, but they'll remember how you made them feel. And it's so true. So it's funny. I never really thought a lot about legacy or what I leave behind until I started doing these conversations. And then so many people I speak to, it is something they think about. I think, I probably should have a word with myself about that, really. I suppose a couple of good disco songs isn't a bad contribution, but I could probably muster up a bit more than that if I dig a bit deeper. I'll do my best. Anyway, in the meantime, I know I spoke about Christmas a little bit before the chat with Alice with you, but I actually even ordered a Christmas present today. Oh, yes. What has happened to me? This is a bit of a shock, isn't it? I don't know. I don't know who I am these days. I barely recognise myself. So, let's see how long that lasts. It's a bit like this decluttering phase I've had. I just know it's about to finish. I just know any minute now I'm going to be like, sod it, leave it to be a mercy. In fact, I'm already sort of slightly losing the bug. The thing is, I did loads of sorting and then like a week later, it all looks like it's back to normal and I just can't be bothered.
It has to. Everybody else has to care a little bit about it too. Anyway, I've got happier things in my midst. Tonight, I'm out for dinner with my mum and the rest of my family because it was her birthday last weekend and we couldn't all get together. And we're going to a place where they do really good Italian food and also Negronis. So I don't think I'll be caring about anything in a few hours' time except for good times with the fam. And on that note, I will love you and leave you. I'll see you next week. Thank you for stopping by. Lots of love. Be kind to yourself. Bye bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for ways to win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.